Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Will Sipling, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we will be talking to Dr. James K. Wellman, Jr. about his new book, High on God, How Megachurches Won the Heart of America, co-authored with Dr. Katie E. Corcoran and Kate J. Stockley, published in 2020 by Oxford University Press. Dr. Wellman, or Jim, is professor and chair of the Comparative Religion Program at the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington, and the author of other books such as The Gold Coast Church and the Ghetto and Evangelical versus Liberal, The Clash of Christian Cultures in the Pacific Northwest. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Will.
That's a short introduction for a long career. Do you want to fill in any gaps before we get started about the book?
Oh, you know, I've been studying religious congregations for a long time and didn't intend to study megachurches, but they became so popular and so big during my career that it became obvious that this is the way Americans do religion these days is through megachurches. So that's kind of what brought me to the project.
So that desire to study churches in particular, which turned into, this book, the culmination of, I think you said, about 4 years of research. How did you get started in jumping into going to various megachurch church services? What kind of invoked, what was the inspiration behind the book and your studies for it?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, my dissertation was on a liberal megachurch. And in general, most megachurches in America are evangelical of one type or another. And so I've always been interested in how religion functions well and why do certain churches grow? Why do certain religions grow? And so early on, I was fascinated by a downtown church in Chicago, Fourth Presbyterian Church, and it was nearly a 4,000 member church itself, which is highly unusual, especially today. So all along, I've been interested in how the growth of churches and in fact, how they die. And then when I came to the Pacific Northwest and the University of Washington, I began to think about churches in this region. And I don't know if you know this, but churched life in the Pacific Northwest is rather rare, and most people don't go to church. But I did find and begin to find megachurches even in the Pacific Northwest. For instance, there are 50 megachurches in Washington State. And so it just became obvious that this is a big movement, and I think it is the way that most people do church. I think 50% of Americans who go to church in some form or another are attending a megachurch. So that's a huge percentage of the American population. So I think it's a critical idea and a critical question to ask, you know, what's going on? Why are most Americans doing religion in these big atmospheres.
So that definitely makes sense then, that if this is the way that people are doing church in 2020, 2019, and when this kind of emerged, as a scholar of religion, this is where one would definitely turn to look next.
Yeah, you know, think about it this way. In 2000, I think there were 600 mega churches. That is people, 2,000 members in attendance or more in the United States. But today, I think in 2020, something over 2,000 of those mega churches exist. So it is a growing phenomena. And we would argue that in our book that this is the way people do church these days. And so we wanted to figure out why. And so the research that we did was really in combination with a group who put together the research study, and it was 25,000 surveys, along with 500 actual interviews with newcomers, with longtime members, and with leaders. I think what I would say to your readers is that this really tells you what's going on in the internal life of these churches and in the inner life of the members of these churches and their leaders. So you really get a good sense of what's going on in church life in American culture.
You sort of describe the work of the megachurch and really your book here as something like a story. And you start in the first section here by talking about desire, which is probably not the first way that I would have assumed a work of what I would consider to be sociology to talk about desire. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I grew up and went to the University of Chicago and in my PhD program. And so rational thought was the only way that we would do and think about religion. And so we thought that people are rational thinkers when it comes to religion. Or that was the presupposition that we took into many of our studies, Max Weber and others. And so what was important was theology. So thinking about what you believe and thinking about what you do when you do theology. That was the work of scholarship. But over these past 20 years, as I've done this work in the study of religion, it just became utterly clear that thinking and thought processing is not the pathway into people's understanding of God or spirituality. That fundamentally, when people turn to what they think is God or spirit, it's out of desire for some sense of completion or peace or salvation. You know, Christians would talk about it that way. And so at the heart, you know, this is a big change for us. At the heart of religion is an embodied perception of experiencing what they see as salvation and freedom and joy in God or in Christ, as Christians would say. So that really transformed our whole thinking about how we do and think about how we do scholarship and the study of religion. And I would argue that I think that is the key basis. I think people become religious out of desire. And what we came up with is this whole idea, and this really happened about 3 or 4 years ago. I was at a retreat and I was reading an essay by Emile Durkheim. And Durkheim had this idea that humans are homo duplex. And I know that's a complicated word or phrase, but what he really meant was that humans are both intensely social, but also intensely individual in their desires. And so the real challenge for the human condition is to bring together both the desire for personal fulfillment and that fulfillment in a group. And so we began to think of megachurches as the ideal kind of merging of both this desire for as we said, to be high on God, which is a phrase that we got from one of the respondents, but also to be merged with a group. And those two things are often in friction in our own culture, and people are struggling with how to fulfill themselves, but also to do it within a group setting. How do you mix those two things? This is really, we really argue this is kind of one of the fundamental challenges of what it means to be a human. And that mega churches, interestingly enough, are in one sense an answer to that question. Now, I don't think megachurch pastors are studying Emil Durkheim and thinking about homo duplex, but they certainly are in the process of doing what they do, fulfilling this kind of fundamental need for human beings to be fulfilled in themselves, but also with and for each other.
So this emotive language combined with Durkheim's analysis helps to explain the title of the book, High on God. But maybe you could maybe walk us through a little bit more what that means. This sounds like it's related to drugs or some other visceral sort of high. Maybe just go into that a little bit more.
Sure. You know, I'll give you a personal experience. This is, I talk about this in the beginning of the book. My background is I went to the Princeton Seminary and became a Presbyterian minister and was active and have been active in the church as a leader, but got more interested in scholarship. And so I did my PhD and went in, you know, obviously I'm working teaching at the University of Washington. So these aren't just professional issues. They're personal issues. So I know what churches do, and I've led church services and I've preached and done all those things, kind of in a liberal Protestant tradition. So in one of the churches that I visited as a part of this study is a large church, and I won't tell you the specifics of it, but it had five services and each service was the same and was quite an integrated congregation and very powerful preacher. So there's five services on Sunday and each one is the same and about 3,000 people come to each service. And I had, as a sociologist, I had sat in different areas of the congregation. And in the third service, I was sitting, taking notes like a good sociologist. And as the call to conversion or the altar call came up after the sermon, I was continuing to take notes and I was just sitting there and, all of a sudden this, very powerful emotion, spirit, whatever you want to call it, Christians would call that the Holy Spirit, came over me. And, from my neck down, my whole body more or less involuntarily wanted to walk up to the altar to embrace the pastor and be saved. I think people will find this kind of peculiar, especially if they have not experienced this, but it was, I use the word radically empirical. That is, it was real. It wasn't just in my head. In fact, it wasn't in my head at all. It was in my body. Now I didn't respond. Basically as a scholar, I said to myself, well, this is unethical. I can't participate in the research that I'm doing. So I didn't go forward, but I had to talk my body out of it. And that lasted about a minute. So what I would say to people who are studying this phenomena of religion. Yeah, William James talks about this theory of radical empiricism. And so he takes seriously not just what one thinks, but how one feels and one's perceptions and one's full experience of what it means to be alive. And I think that's really important in the study of religion. And so that's really what I'm trying to do in this book, is try to explain to outsiders, particularly, what happens in these churches and why are they so powerful? And it's not just in the head. It's really in the body. And so we, in the process of writing the book, we came up with a theory of religion, this kind of embodied choice theory, to get away from rational choice theory, and to say, no, this is an embodying process. And then we tried to explain that and show the steps by which mega churches do this work.
I'd love to go more into that. And the second section talks about that. But before we do that, you've mentioned in Washington and Oregon, and obviously there are bastions of mega churches here in the United States, but you do spend a good deal of time in the first section talking about the origins of the mega church phenomenon does not necessarily come from, say, Protestantism or even Americanism. Where does this megachurch idea come from?
Yeah, this looking at megachurches kind of forced us to begin to think about this process in a long range historical view. And I began to think of St. Paul in particular. I don't think Jesus fits the whole idea of a megachurch pastor. Although what I would say about that is that Jesus's appeal is deeply emotional. It's obviously within the teaching mode of those early first century rabbis, but there's a sense in which Jesus is known for his love, and people experience that and were drawn to it. And many of his healing miracles were not because he intentionally touched someone, but somebody touched him and felt healed. And so that healing process, you know, the whole idea of embodied choice theory is that this is a power external to us, and we want to feel it in our bodies. And so I think Jesus, in that sense, is kind of the perfect exemplar of that process. But also Jesus brought disciples to him, obviously, and then sent them out. And so the process of coming together and then going out to fulfill this good news and to share this good news, not just to the Jew, but to the Gentile, to all people, is the beginning of something quite extraordinary, obviously, in terms of Christian history. But the person that we really thought was the key factor, the kind of, you know, I suppose the earliest megachurch pastor is I think St. Paul, who, you know, had basically created congregations all over the Mediterranean, even into the West and to the East. So, you know, we began to think of St. Paul as kind of an early sort of megachurch pastor in the making. In that sense, I would say that this is not just an American phenomena. And we know today, for instance, that megachurches are huge in Latin America. I just got back from a conference in Israel and at the University of Haifa on Jewish and Christian Zionism, which is another phenomena altogether. But we had many scholars from Latin America, and particularly from Brazil, where megachurches are huge. Pentecostal prosperity gospel megachurches, which are also quite Zionist, in an interesting kind of phenomena going on. And so it's clear that this, you know, I began to think after listening to these 15 or 20 scholars on Brazil that prosperity gospel Pentecostal churches are the civil religion of Brazil these days. And I think in the Southern Hemisphere, the spread in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, megachurches are huge. The prosperity gospel is a powerful motivator for folks. And so this whole embodied theory of religion is really obvious now that this is not just a rational choice that people are making. They are making it because they are, let's to use the title of my book, High on God. And it's real. William James again said that anything that's empirical has real effects in the world. These churches have huge effects in the world, politically, culturally, and in terms of healing families and to helping families maintain, their discipline and staying together, et cetera. And then across history, I think in various forms, you see the development, particularly in the West, of the construction of buildings as that this became possible, that allowed for large populations of human beings to gather together. And as we talk about in our megachurch book, co-presence, that is co-presence with a large group of people. I mean, the Super Bowl is one of those obvious examples of the power of co-presence, is spectacularly potent on what happens inside human bodies. And so this co-presence became possible because architecture developed and buildings could hold larger and larger groups of people. And the Reformation took on, building larger structures. And then, of course, in the Americas and in England, you get the development of preachers who are not just preaching for their single congregation, but are literally hitting the trail and beginning to go into the streets and preach to the masses. And so you have a whole history of the development of this idea of reaching out to the largest group possible with your message of the freedom of the gospel.
So it sounds like what you're describing there are those pistons of desire and power, which does relate to what you mentioned a minute ago about this new decision theory that you've come up with, this embodied choice theory. And you bring out in the second section there these sort of six core desires that really make the megachurch work, like what causes it to be the influence that it is. Could you tell us a little bit more about this embodied choice theory and these six key core desires?
After studying these churches, we began to try to figure out, like, what is the process by which people enter into these churches and become caught up in these churches? And through these, 25 surveys, 25,000 surveys and all these interviews, we began to chart out and pick up on themes. And obviously, one of the early themes was a sense of belonging and kind of radical acceptance. When you come into these churches, not all mega churches, but many have people who are basically there to greet you. One mega church we talk about is it was raining and these young people came out of the building, opened the doors with coffee and umbrellas and met us in the parking lot and, basically escorted us into the building. And you can't help but feel like, ah, wow, all my needs are being met. And I feel accepted, and they ask your name and they, then you come in, to these environments. And you're immediately met often by young people who are smiling and have information. And especially if you have children, there's a group for Sunday school that tells you where each of your child is welcome to come. Everyone's smiling. It's clean. It looks organized. It looks like people care about you. It feels good to be there. And this is a huge deal, especially for newcomers, is a sense of welcome and a sense that I'm accepted. So, you know, it's kind of this fundamental human desire is to belong somewhere and to be accepted. And megachurches pull this together really, really very well.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to touch on every single one of these. I'm just looking on page 81. You've got them all laid out. If there's any that just really appeal to you, just feel free to, you know, just keep talking through them as you'd like.
So, you know, after this sense of being accepted is, you know, you come into these congregations and they're usually huge halls. So the challenge for these megachurch members and pastors is to allow people to feel welcome, even though they're in this huge space. And these buildings are usually look really more like huge caverns. So it's really a struggle. So a part of this is the musical element of megachurches. And there's been work done on this. And music, you know, popular music that megachurches use is very much a produced mode. People make fun of it. But when we talk to people who had studied how the production of music happens, it is a very specific type of pattern that they're looking for. And that is a kind of a slowdown, a speed up, and then a slowdown. So that there's kind of movement even within the singing so that people feel moved towards a sense of being welcomed, a sense of what we call the hack the happy. That is a sense that, wow, this is the place to be. This is the place I want to be. And many of these churches are really looking for and hungering for young people. And so there has to be music that is relatable to young people. And so that is very much, you know, they invest incredible amounts of capital in their musical systems and their sound systems. And so that's, you know, a part of this process is to make people feel at home, that this music is relatable. It's music that you've heard before on the radio. It's music that makes you feel like you're a part of something really, very powerful. And the third desire is, and, you know, I think this is a desire that many people look for, is that some sort of reliable leader. And, you know, of course, what we'd say about megachurches is that they're led by charismatic individuals usually. And a lot of people wonder, you know, what is charisma? What is charisma? And what we sort of our shorthand for that is a reliable leader. And that is somebody who you can relate to, somebody who is looks like you in some sense or another, and has a sense that of where you are. So many of these pastors will talk about their own lives and talk about their own problems and talk about questions that you have in your own personal life, in your own professional life. And then they begin to use the scripture, use their personal stories, use stories from their lives to kind of weave an answer to the questions that you have coming into this these congregations, these megachurches. And so what we found from the surveys is that these megachurch members feel like their pastor is speaking directly to them, directly to their heart, directly to their head, directly to their existential being. So it's quite an experience when you see people talking about their pastor as if he were Jesus. In fact, many people compare their megachurch pastors to Jesus, that the spirit of Jesus just pours through him. And, you know, that kind of is a central factor in why these megachurches really grow and die. You know, we've seen and studied churches where a megachurch pastor either had to retire or had to leave for some other reason. And, you know, it's sort of like the electricity goes out of the room. And the charisma that I've talked about is really disappears. So you know, and then you know the next factor, the fourth factor is deliverance. And I think a lot of people kind of are suspicious of this. That is, you know, what is this? Are people being manipulated at these churches? Is this kind of a manipulative process whereby they get you to be happy, they get you to feel welcome, they get you to feel accepted, they get you to feel like you need them, and then they offer you salvation and then they got you, and then they got your money. I think a lot of outsiders would feel and say that these megachurches are kind of manipulative and wanting people's money. Now, it's not as if they don't get money. I mean, it's that what we found is that these churches are able to take in and function at a very spectacular rate, in part because they are able to get folks to tithe. What that means, to give 10% of their income, which is, you know, a huge amount of money in many of these churches that we think about. But more than that, more than a manipulation, is the fact that people feel delivered, that there's some problem or question that these pastors are able to answer, and there's a sense of deliverance, whether it's from an old habit, drug habit, or from a bad relationship, or from being stuck in a job, or from you know, whatever existential crisis a person might be going through. Over and over again, we found through the interviews is that these people feel that they have found an answer, and it's practical. It's not just abstract, that they found a new vocation, or they found a new way of being, or they found happiness that they had never felt before, or they found forgiveness for a past error in their life or sin or whatever you want to call it that they were trying to get over, or that they found hope that overflows now, and they want to come back to these services over and over again. So you know, in one of these congregations that I attended, was the day before I was in the congregation on Sunday, and the day before, the church had just sent out 600 volunteers to a city park, and the city elders had not been able to have the money to fix up the city park, and so 600 volunteers from that church basically repainted and fixed up and really refurbished the whole park. And not only that, but the church had thought of the idea of creating a place where people could come and get food in a clothing pantry. And they gave out free certificates to policemen and to firefighters in the whole city, so that if they came upon people that were in need, they could give them these certificates and people could come to the church and get whatever they needed. So, you know, I think what we discovered is that these, you know, we were really suspicious of these churches. We really were. But we came away with the idea that these churches really are meeting people's needs, and then also sending them out to serve and help others in the community, regardless of whether people believed or not. And so the, you know, the last thing that the last kind of desire that they meet is this desire for, you know, congregation, that is to be friends with each other. So they create small groups, and small groups are really a part and a key part of all these mega churches. And that is they get with people who are similar to them in six to 10 to 15 people in each group. And then they go through processes of finding out about themselves, about each other, discovering their unique capacities and gifts, praying for each other, having food together, and meeting kind of these, you know, fundamental human needs for companionship, for, and of course, you know, many marriages come out of this, out of these mega churches, people finding their mates. So, you know, with all of this, I'm saying that I came in very suspicious. We were very suspicious of these mega churches. And we came away thinking, no, they're doing kind of fundamental core things for human beings that are not met in elsewhere. And so it was kind of overwhelming to us after a while that these churches were doing real good in their congregations, in their communities.
I must admit, I had a similar bias coming into reading this book, wondering how these mega churches could be depicted, because as we know, there is a darker side to these goods that they're answering, that some of these things can be manipulated. And you do spend the third section of the book talking about how the parts of mega churches which are compelling can be used for bad, or that there are parts of mega churches that just seem to have in their essence these negative things, such as soft patriarchy, or even thinking about things like hashtag Me Too or hashtag Church Too. Could you talk a little bit more about these negative aspects of mega churches?
You know, like I said, I mean, we had our own prejudices coming into the study, and we wanted to sort of be the book that, you know, exposed what the mega churches were really all about. And so this book took, in fact, I think you said it 4 years, it really took 7 years. And about halfway through that process, we realized that scandals are not the story of megachurches, and that most megachurches are doing these goods for people. And so that was kind of a shock. That was really a learning that we had to come to grips with, to really figure out what was going on here. But scandals are, you know, they're interesting and they're scandalous. I mean, some of the scandals are so crazy, it's almost bizarre. But what we did then was, you know, as sociologists, we wanted to figure out what's the rate of scandals in terms of megachurches. And we assumed the rate of scandal within megachurches would be relatively high. But after going through all the scandals over the last 20 years, we calculated that megachurches scandals occur in megachurches at a rate of 1 to 2%. So that number itself kind of shocked us, is that this is not a common occurrence, at least as far as what we could tell. And honestly, and to your listeners, we were looking for scandals. And we just didn't find that many. But of course we found, you know, the scandals are all over the newspapers. So if all you read was newspaper accounts of mega churches, you'd think that that's all they do is create scandals. And of course the scandals are salacious. I mean, they're horrendous. But they're typical really of the human condition. And we basically discovered that most are either have to do with sex or with money, which, you know, that's what else do human beings do when they do something scandalous, is that these pastors, and we use this theory of soft patriarchalism, that is, these pastors weren't controlling in sort of a hideous sort of way, but when things went badly, pastors would use their power, their patriarchal power, to manipulate either young people or women, in the case of Bill Hybels, or going after money within the system to control and to manipulate people into either sexual favors or coming away from those churches with more money than they ought. So, you know, the scandals are the thing that most people know about mega churches who don't really are not familiar with these churches. But from our point of view, that really wasn't the story, even though that's what we read in the newspaper. The surprise of the book is that the mega churches are not altogether are relatively infrequent in terms of scandals.
I have to say, I was surprised when I saw Appendix C, which is sort of a list of scandals, and it's only 3 full page spreads. You're right. If one just simply reads the news, it seems as if there's some new scandal happening every week at your local neighborhood church. But it is good to know that more of this impact is a group of 600 people fixing a local park or helping those who don't have the means to help themselves, which is a good end to the story, I think, in some ways. But you mentioned that you...
I really wish... my fear is that people will look at this, the title of this book, and think that it is kind of sarcastic or cynical. And in many ways, we started from that perspective, but we came away with an altogether different point of view on this, is that in fact, these churches have become places where human beings can flourish. And so I think that's an untold story. And I really hope that the book is received as a surprise for many people. that in fact, things aren't as bad as what people think they are. And that churches are trying to do the best they can to really engage people. You know, one of the things I would end with is that megachurches in many ways are kind of the recreation of small towns within big cities often, or suburbs. And so what we kind of came to think about this is that megachurches really are reintroducing community and a sense of community for Americans. And we know that Americans in general are, you know, deeply lonely and have a hard time finding companionship and a sense of community. And that so megachurches are, I think, really kind of a source that is, you know, in some ways untapped for many people. So that's my way of saying I really hope people read the book, because I think they'll be surprised.
As I mentioned, I definitely was, but it is hopeful, I think, to see that these benefits, these much needed benefits, are being carried out. I think there's a lot that many in different faith traditions have to learn from this phenomenon.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that about wraps up our time, Jim. Before we close up, I'd like to know if there's any other projects that you're working on that you'd like to share with us.
Well, you know what? In the last 2 years, I've done a course on a life worth living, and I've called it Religion 101. And what I do is for undergraduates at my university, I take them through, a 10-week course on various pieces of literature and experiences where people have found a life worth living. And what I've discovered is that many of our undergraduates have no contact with, you know, the great literature of religion, philosophy, and sources of uplift. And so it's been eye-opening to watch undergraduates come at the end of these courses and write 10-page papers on their philosophy and their plan for their lives, and see them kind of come alive for the first time. And so this isn't about converting anyone. It's really using the sources of the Western tradition to say to young people, hey, there's sources of encouragement, sources of inspiration, sources of community service that you can draw upon to really make a life worth living. And so it's been very fun to see the responses from it. And so, you know, out of that, I've kind of begin to think about a book that I might write based on the experience in this course. And another project that we're doing is a less positive and less inspiring project, but that is on religious nationalism. And of course, we're thinking about Trump and white nationalism in America. I mean, Trump, in a sense, is America's megachurch pastor par excellence. And the way in which he uses Christianity to his benefit, but that's not such a positive project. But this is going on, kind of the binding together of religion and nationalism is happening in Latin America. It's happening in Africa. It's happening parts of Europe. It's happening in Asia. So I think it's kind of a unique phenomena in our political life as a world. So that's something we're working on as well.
And it's definitely a topic that needs more work as well. As well as your course, both of these things seem very pertinent in today's time. But we've been talking with Dr. Jim Wellman on his new book, High on God: How Megachurches Won the Heart of America. Jim, thanks so much for coming on the show. We've been happy to have you.
Yeah, it's been great to be with you, Will. I appreciate it.
Great, thanks. And we'll talk to you again, perhaps when the new book on religion and nationalism comes out.
Yes, that'd be great.